Trace of a Dynasty. August 4th, 1937, Shangtu, China. The muffled booms in the distance echoed with the pall of a tribal war drum. First a subtle pop would waft through the air, followed by an inevitable jarring thud a few seconds later. The lazy pause between each beat led to a false hope that the acoustic barrage had finally come to an end. Then another quiet pop would ring through the air, unnerving all within earshot as they waited for the impact to follow. Lee Hunt stood up from a freshly dug earthen trench and stretched his arms skyward before carefully setting a hand trowel atop a nearby mud brick wall. The Oxford-educated field archaeologist for the British Museum was dressed for the part, clad in long khaki pants and matching dual-pocket shirt, both of which were coated in a fine layer of dust and sweat. Instead of the classic pith helmet, he wore a battered fedora to shield his head from the rays of the summer sun. Through tired hazel eyes, he peered east down a wide valley toward the source of the thundering noise. For the first time, small puffs of smoke could be seen on the horizon through the shimmering heat of the morning sun.
"Sendin, it would appear that the artillery is moving closer," he spoke nonchalantly in the direction of the trench.
A short man wearing a thin woolen shirt with a red sash tied around his waist climbed quietly out of the pit. Beyond him in the trench, a crew of Chinese laborers continued digging through the dry soil with heavy spades and hand trowels. Unlike the Chinese workers, the small but broad-shouldered man had slightly rounded eyes, which were embedded in a face of dark, leathery skin. They were features that the local Chinese knew at a glance belonged to a Mongolian.
"Peking is falling. Already the refugees are fleeing," he said, pointing toward a small dirt road a mile away.
Rolling through the dust, a half-dozen ox-drawn carts toted the life possessions of several Chinese families escaping to the west.
"We must abandon the excavation, sir, before the Japanese are upon us."
Hunt instinctively felt for the .455 caliber Webley Fosbury automatic revolver holstered at his hip. Two nights before, he had shot at a small gang of marauding bandits that attempted to steal a crate of excavated artifacts. In the environment of China's collapsing infrastructure, bands of thieves seemed to roam everywhere, but most were unarmed and unsophisticated. Fighting his way past the Japanese Imperial Army would be an entirely different matter. China was rapidly imploding under the juggernaut of the Japanese military might. Ever since the renegade Japanese Guangdong Army had seized Manchuria in 1931, Japan's military leaders had set their sights on colonizing China in the manner of Korea. 6 years of thrusts and parries and staged incidents finally erupted in the summer of 1937 when the Japanese Imperial Army invaded northern China in fear that the nationalist forces of Chiang Kai-shek were growing too strong. Though the Chinese forces vastly outnumbered the Japanese army, they were no match for the superior equipment, training, and discipline that the Japanese forces brought to the field. Utilizing his resources as best he could, Chiang Kai-shek battled the Japanese by day, then retreated at night in an attempt to slow the Japanese advance in a war of attrition. Hunt listened to the crack of the approaching Japanese artillery that now signaled the loss of Peking, and he knew that the Chinese were in trouble. The capital city of Nanking would be next, resulting in yet a further pullback to the west of Chiang Kai-shek's army. With an impending sense of his own defeat, he glanced at his wristwatch, then spoke to Tsendin.
"Have the coolies cease all excavations at noon. We'll secure the artifacts and complete final documentation of the site this afternoon, then join in the growing caravan heading west."
Glancing at the road, he noted a ragtag band of Chinese nationalist soldiers filtering into the evacuation route.
"You will be leaving on the aircraft to Nanking tomorrow?"
Tsen Din asked.
"Assuming the plane shows up."
"But there's no sense in flying to Nanking under these hostile conditions. I intend to take the most important artifacts and fly north to Ulaanbaatar. You'll have to manage the remaining items, equipment, and supplies with the pack train, I'm afraid. You should be able to catch up with me in Ulaanbaatar in a few weeks. I'll wait for you there before catching the Trans-Siberian Railway west."
"A wise move. It is evident that the local resistance is failing.
Inner Mongolia offers little strategic value to the Japanese. They are likely just chasing the remnants of the defensive forces out of Peking," he said, waving an arm toward the distant artillery barrage. "I suspect they will pull back shortly and enjoy a few days or even weeks pillaging Peking before renewing the offensive. Plenty of time for us to be on our way."
"It is unfortunate that we must leave now. We are nearly finished with the excavation of the Pavilion of Great Harmony," Tsen Din said, surveying a maze of excavated trenches that stretched around them like a World War I battlefield.
"It's a bloody shame," Hunt said, shaking his head in anger, "though we've proven that the site has already been well ransacked." Hunt kicked at some excavated fragments of marble and stone piled near his feet and watched as the dust settled over the remnants that had once constituted an imposing imperial structure. While most of his archaeological contemporaries in China were chasing prehistoric burial tombs loaded with bronze artifacts, Hunt's focus was on the more recent Yuan Dynasty. This was his third summer on the grounds of Shangdu, excavating the remains of the royal summer palace built in 1260. Staring at a barren hillside dotted with mounds of fresh dirt, it was difficult to imagine the former grandeur of the palace and grounds that would have stood before him nearly 800 years earlier. Though surviving Chinese historical records provide scant detail, Marco Polo, the Venetian adventurer who vividly documented 13th century China and the Silk Road in his book, The Travels, provided a striking description of Shangtu at its zenith. Built on a huge mound at the center of a walled city, the original palace was surrounded by a forest of transplanted trees and lapis lazuli stone paths, which lent a magical blue hue to the estate. Exquisite gardens and fountains weaved through a series of government buildings and residences that encircled the Ta'an Ko, or Pavilion of Great Harmony, which stood as the imperial palace. Constructed of green marble and stone and gilded with gold, the great structure was inlaid with glazed tiles and decorated with breathtaking paintings and sculptures from China's most skilled artisans. Used primarily as a summer residence by the emperor to escape the heat of Peking, Shangtu quickly developed into a scientific and cultural hub. A medical center and astronomical observatory were constructed, and the city became a haven for scholars both foreign and domestic. A constant breeze across the hilltop cooled the emperor and his guests as he administered over an empire that stretched from the Mediterranean to Korea. But it was the emperor's adjacent hunting ground that perhaps gave the summer palace its most renown. It was a vast enclosed park of trees, streams, and thick grass, encompassing 16 square miles. The park was stocked with deer, boar, and other game for the hunting pleasure of the emperor and his guests. Elevated paths circled through the preserve to keep the hunter's feet dry. Surviving tapestries show the emperor hunting in the park on a favorite horse, with a trained hunting cheetah at his side. Centuries of abandonment, neglect, and looting had reduced the palace to little more than scattered rubble. It was nearly impossible for Hunt to picture the lush grounds of gardens, fountains, springs, and trees as they existed centuries ago. The landscape was now barren. A wide grassy plain stretched empty to the distant brown hills. The area was void of life, the city's past glory just a whisper on the wind that ruffled through the tall grass. Xanadu, the romantic name of Shangtu, popularized by the Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem, existed now only in the imagination. With approval from the nationalist government, Hunt had begun excavations 3 years before. Trowel by trowel, he had been able to piece together the boundaries of the Palace of Great Harmony, identifying a grand hall, a kitchen, and a dining hall. An assortment of bronze and porcelain artifacts recovered from the earth told the tale of daily life at the palace. But, to Hunt's disappointment, there were no dazzling artifacts uncovered, no terracotta armies or Ming vases that would make a name for himself. The dig was nearly completed. Just the remains of the royal bedroom chamber remained to be excavated. Already, most of his colleagues had fled the eastern regions of China, not wanting to get caught up in a civil war or foreign invasion. Hunt seemed to perversely enjoy the turmoil and pending danger from the site in northwest China, not far from Manchuria. With a love of antiquity and drama, he knew that he was standing thick in the middle of history in the making. Hunt also knew that the British Museum would be pleased with whatever artifacts he would provide them for their planned exhibit of Xanadu. The chaos and danger created by the Japanese invasion was actually a benefit. Not only did it add to the allure of the artifacts that he transported west, it actually made the process easier. Local authorities had already fled the nearby villages, and the government antiquities officials had not been seen in weeks. He would have an easy time removing the artifacts from the country. That is, assuming he could extricate himself as well. "I guess I've kept you from your family long enough, Tsendin. I doubt the Russians will allow the Japanese to pussyfoot around in Mongolia, so you should be safe from this craziness. My wife shall welcome my return." The Mongol smiled through a yellowing set of sharply pointed teeth. The faint drone of a nearby aircraft halted their conversation. To the south of them, a small gray speck grew larger in the sky before banking to the east. "Japanese reconnaissance aircraft," Hunt mused. "Not a good sign for the nationalist chaps if the Japanese own the skies." The archaeologist pulled out a pack of Red Lion cigarettes and lit one of the unfiltered smokes as Sendin peered at the fading aircraft with a nervous look. "The sooner we are away, the better, I think," he said. Behind them, a sudden commotion erupted from one of the excavation trenches. One of the Chinese laborers' heads popped up over the edge, his grimy jaws jabbering at a rapid clip. "What is it?" Hunt said, setting down his tea. "He says he's found some lacquered wood," Sendin replied, stepping toward the trench. Both men walked to the edge and peered down. The chattering laborer excitedly pointed his trowel toward the ground as the other laborers crowded around. Barely exposed through the dirt at his feet was a flat, square, yellow object the size of a serving platter. "Tsendin, you handle the excavation," Hunt barked, waving away the other laborers. As the Mongolian jumped into the trench and carefully began scraping the dirt away with a trowel and brush, Hunt retrieved a notebook and pencil. Thumbing to a hand-drafted sketch of the localized area and trench, he neatly outlined the object in its discovered location. Flipping to a blank sheet, he then began sketching the artifact while Tsendin gently dug around it. As the dirt and dust fell away, Hunt could see that the object was in fact a yellow lacquered wooden box. Every square inch was painted with delicate images of animals and trees in elaborate detail, trimmed with inlaid mother of pearl. Hunt noted with curiosity that an elephant was depicted on the lid. Carefully scraping the dirt away to its base, Zendin gently lifted the box out of the sediment and placed it on a flat stone outside the trench. The Chinese laborers all stopped their digging and crowded around the ornate box. Most of their discoveries to date consisted of little more than broken shards of porcelain and the occasional jade carving. This was easily the most impressive item uncovered in their 3 years of digging. Hunt studied the box deliberately before taking it in his hands and lifting it. Something heavy was inside, which shifted as he moved the box. With his thumbs, he could feel a seam midway around the shallow sides and gently tried to separate the lid. The box, sealed for nearly 800 years, protested at first and then slowly opened. Hunt set the box down and gingerly worked his fingers around the entire edge, then pulled on the lid until it creaked off. Zendin and the laborers all leaned in as if in a football huddle, peering to see what was inside. Two objects were nestled in the box, and Hunt removed them for all to see. A spotted animal skin, colored black and yellow in the camouflage pattern of a leopard or cheetah, was rolled up like a scroll, the ends tied together with leather straps. The other item was a patinated bronze tube, sealed at one end, but with a removable cap at the other end. The Chinese workers all grinned and chuckled at the sight of the objects, not knowing what significance they held, but assuming correctly that they had some importance. Hunt set down the cheetah skin and examined the heavy bronze tube. It had aged a deep green color, which only enhanced the elaborate image of a dragon that stretched along its length. The tail of the imaginary beast curled around the capped end of the tube like a coil of rope.
"Go ahead. Open it up," Zendin urged with excited impatience.
Hunt easily pried off the end cap, then held the tube up to his eye, peering in. He then turned the open end toward the ground and carefully shook the tube, catching with his open left palm the contents as it slid out. It was a rolled-up bolt of silk, dyed a pale blue. Zendin shook clean a nearby blanket and spread it across the ground at Hunt's feet. The archaeologist waited for the dust to clear, then knelt down over the blanket and carefully unfurled the silk roll to its full length of nearly 5 feet. Zendin noticed the normally unflappable archaeologist's hands trembled slightly as he smoothed out the creases in the silk. A picturesque landscape scene was painted on the silk, portraying a mountaintop with deep valleys, gorges, and streams depicted in beautiful detail. But the silk was obviously much more than an ornamental work of art. Along the left border was a sizable section of text that Hunt recognized as Uyghur script, the earliest Mongolian written language adopted from early Turkish settlers to the Asian steppes. On the right margin was a sequence of smaller images depicting a harem of women, herds of horses, camels, and other animals, and a contingent of armed soldiers surrounding several wooden chests. The landscape portion of the painting was bare of life except for a lone figure at the very center of the silk roll. Standing on a small mountain rise was a Bactrian camel draped with a saddle cloth inscribed with two words. Oddly, the camel was painted weeping, shedding oversized tears that fell to the ground. As he studied the silk painting, a band of sweat formed across Hunt's forehead. He suddenly felt his heart thumping loudly in his chest, and he had to force himself to take a deep breath of air. "Just couldn't be," he thought. "Zendin. Zendin," he muttered, nearly afraid to ask. "It is Uyghur script. Can you read what it says?" The Mongol assistant's eyes grew to the size of silver dollars as he, too, grasped the meaning of the image. He stuttered and stumbled as he tried to translate for Hunt.
"The wording on the left is a physical description of the mountainous region in the painting. At home atop Mount Burkhan Khaldun, nestled in the Khenti Mountains, our emperor sleeps. The Onon River quenches his thirst between the valleys of the doomed."
"And the inscription on the camel?" Hunt whispered, pointing a shaky finger at the center of the painting.
"Temujin Kagan,"
Sendin replied, choking the words out in a hushed tone of reverence.
"Temujin."
Hunt repeated the word as if in a trance. Though the Chinese laborers failed to comprehend, Hunt and Sendin realized with shock that they had made a discovery of astounding proportions. A wave of emotion surged over Hunt as he digested the enormity of the silk painting. Though he tried to mentally question its content, the power of the description was just too overwhelming. The weeping camel, the offerings depicted on the side, the locale description. Then there was the name on the camel's back.
Temujin.
It was the birth name of a tribal boy who became the world's greatest conqueror. History would remember him by his royally appointed moniker, Genghis Khan. The ancient silk painting before them could be nothing other than a diagram of the hidden burial site of Genghis Khan. Hunt collapsed to his knees as the realization of the find sunk in. The grave of Genghis Khan was one of the most sought-after archaeological sites in history. In an amazing tale of conquest, Genghis Khan had united the Mongol tribes of the Asian steppes and expanded on a march of conquest the likes of which have never been matched since. Between 1206 and 1223 AD, he and his nomadic horde captured lands as far west as Egypt and as far north as Lithuania. Genghis died in 1227 AD at the height of his power and was known to have been secretly buried in the Khenti Mountains of Mongolia, not far from his birthplace. In the Mongol tradition, he was buried secretly with 40 concubines and untold riches, the gravesite carefully concealed by his subjects after interment. Ordinary foot soldiers who accompanied the cortege were put to death, while their commanders were sworn to silence upon threat of similar punishment. Any hint as to the location of the gravesite vanished as those in the know expired, keeping their loyal vow of silence to the very end. Only a camel, or so the legend went, tipped off the location a decade or so later. A Bactrian pack camel, known to be the mother of a camel interred with the great leader, was found weeping at a spot in the Khenti Mountains. The camel's owner realized it was crying for its lost son buried beneath its feet, in the same location where Genghis Khan must be entombed. Yet the fable ended there, the secret kept with the herder, and the grave of Genghis Khan left undisturbed in the Mongolian mountains of his birth. Now, the legend was whisked to life in the silk painting before Hunt's eyes.
"This is a most sacred find," Sendin whispered. "It will lead us to the tomb of the great Khan."
Sendin spoke with a reverence that bordered on fright.
"Yes,"
Hunt gasped, imagining the fame that would sweep his way if he led the discovery of Genghis Khan's grave. Suddenly fearful of exposing the significance of the silk to the Chinese laborers, one of whom might have an eager bandit in the family, Hunt hastily re-rolled the fabric into the tube and replaced it in the lacquered box with the cheetah skin. He then wrapped the box in a cloth and secured it in a large leather satchel, which stayed clasped in his left hand for the rest of the day. After riddling the earth where the box was recovered and finding no other artifacts, Hunt reluctantly ordered a halt to the dig. The laborers quietly stowed their picks, shovels, and brushes into a wooden cart, then stood in line for their meager salary. Though paid just pennies a day, several of the men had actually fought over the physically demanding jobs, which were a rare commodity in the poverty-stricken Chinese provinces. With the equipment and artifacts secured in a trio of wooden carts and the Chinese laborers dismissed, Hunt retired to his canvas tent after dinner with Tendin and packed up his belongings. For the first time, an uneasiness fell over him as he documented the day's events in his personal journal. With the last-minute discovery of the valued artifact, he suddenly became more cognizant of the dangers around him. Looters and bandits had wantonly robbed other excavations in Shanxi province, and a fellow archaeologist had been beaten and pistol-whipped by marauders seeking 3,000-year-old bronze artifacts. Then there was the Japanese army. Though they might not harm a British citizen, they could very well appropriate his work and artifacts. And who knows? Would the discovery of Genghis Khan's grave prove to be a curse for him, as many claimed it was for Lord Carnarvon and the crew that discovered the grave of King Tut? With the satchel containing the wooden box safe under his cot, he slept fitfully, the myriad of thoughts banging around his head like a blacksmith's hammer. The night was made more ominous by the howl of a shrieking wind that rocked the tent till dawn. Rising groggily at daybreak, he was relieved to find the satchel safe and sound under his cot, while, outside, there were no Japanese militants to be seen. Tsendin was standing nearby, cooking some goat meat over an open fire with a pair of Chinese orphan boys who assisted the Mongol.
"Good morning, sir. Hot tea is at the ready."
Tsendin smiled, handing Hunt a cup of steaming brew.
"All of the equipment is packed, and the mules are hitched to the carts. We can depart at your desire."
"Jolly good. Stow my tent, if you would, and take a good mind of that satchel under the cot," he said, taking a seat on a wooden crate and watching the sunrise as he enjoyed his tea.
The first distant artillery shell sounded an hour later as the remaining excavation party rolled away from the Shangtu site aboard 3 mule-drawn wagons. Across the wind-swept plains stood the tiny village of Langqi, just over a mile away. The caravan continued past the dusty town, joining a small trail of refugees headed west. Near noon, the mules clopped into the aged town of Duolun, where they stopped at a roadside hovel for lunch. Downing a tasteless bowl of noodles and broth that was sprinkled with dead bugs, they made their way to a large flat meadow at the edge of town. Sitting atop one of the wagons, Hunt peered overhead into a partly cloudy sky. Almost like clockwork, a faint buzz broke the air, and the archaeologist watched as a tiny silver speck grew larger against the clouds as it approached the makeshift airfield. As the airplane neared, Hunt pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and tied it to a stick, thrusting it into the ground as a primitive windsock for the pilot to gauge the breeze. With a gentle touch, the pilot circled the metal-sided aircraft in a wide, low turn, then set the noisy plane down onto the turf in a quick motion. Hunt was relieved to see the plane was a Fokker F-7B trimotor, a safe and able aircraft aptly suited to flying over remote stretches of barren landscape. He noted with curiosity that the name Blessed Betty was painted beneath the pilot's cockpit window. The motors barely gurgled to a stop when the fuselage door burst open and out jumped two men in worn leather jackets.
"Hunt?" "I'm Randy Shoat," greeted the pilot, a tall man with a rugged yet friendly face who spoke with an American accent. "My brother Dave and I are here to fly you to Nanking, or so the contract says," he added, patting a folded paper in his jacket pocket.
"What's a pair of Yanks doing way out here?" Hunt mused.
"Beats working in the shipyard back home in Erie, Pennsylvania," grinned Dave Shoat, an affable man like his brother who was quick with a joke.
"Been flying for the Chinese Ministry of Railroads, supporting rail extensions on the Peking-Shanghai line. The work has come to a sudden halt with this unpleasantness by these Japanese folks," Randy Shoat explained with a smirk.
"I have a slight change in destination," Hunt said, sidestepping the banter. "I need you to fly me to Ulaanbaatar."
"Mongolia?" Shoat asked, scratching his head.
"Well, as long as we're headed away from the neighborhood of the Nippon Army, I guess it's okay with me."
"I'll plot it out, see if we have the range to get there," Dave said, walking back to the plane.
"Hopefully they'll have a gas station when we arrive." He laughed.
With Shoat's help, Hunt supervised the loading of the more important artifacts and tools into the fuselage of the Fokker. When the wooden crates had nearly filled the interior, Hunt took the satchel with the lacquered box and carefully placed it on the front passenger seat.
"That will be 150 miles less than the flight to Nanking. But we'll need return mileage, which exceeds what your British Museum people contracted me to fly," Shoat explained, spreading a map of the region across a stack of crates. Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia, was marked with a star in the north-central region of the country, over 400 miles from the Chinese border.
"You have my authorization," Hunt replied, handing the pilot a handwritten request for the change in route.
"I assure you, the museum will honor the additional expense."
"Sure they will. They don't want your artifacts to end up in the Tokyo Museum." Shoat laughed. Sticking the note in his pocket, he added, "Dave has the route to Ulaanbaatar laid in and promises we can make it in one hop. Since we'll be flying over the Gobi Desert, you're lucky the Blessed Betty has extra fuel tanks. Whenever you're ready." Hunt walked over and surveyed the two remaining mule carts, still packed with equipment and artifacts. Tsendin stood holding the reins of the lead mule, stroking the animal's ears.
"Tsendin, we have had a difficult but fruitful summer. You have been invaluable in the success of the expedition."
"It has been my honor. You have done a great service to my country and heritage. My heirs shall be particularly grateful."
"Take the remaining equipment and artifacts to Shijiazhuang, where you can catch the rail to Nanking. A representative from the British Museum will meet and arrange shipment of the items to London. I will wait for you in Ulaanbaatar, where we will investigate our latest find."
"I look forward to the next search with great anticipation," Tsendin replied, shaking the archaeologist's hand.
"Farewell, my friend."
Hunt climbed aboard the loaded Fokker as the plane's three 220-horsepower right whirlwind radial engines roared to life. Tsendin stood and watched as Shoat turned the plane into the wind, then shoved the throttles to their stops. With a deafening roar, the aircraft jostled across the meadow, bouncing up and down several times before slowly lumbering into the air. Turning in a graceful arc low above the field, Shoat swung the big plane northwest toward the Mongolian border as it gradually gained altitude. Tsendin stood in the meadow and watched as the plane grew smaller on the horizon and the throbbing of the motors dissolved from his ears. Not until the aircraft had completely vanished from sight did he reach into the vest pocket of his coat for a reassuring touch. The bolt of silk was still there, as it had been since the early hours of the night before. It was 2 hours into the flight when Hunt reached for the satchel and pulled out the lacquered box. The boredom of the flight, mixed with the excitement of the find, was too much to bear, and he was drawn to run the silk painting through his fingers one more time. With the box in his hands, he felt the familiar weight of the bronze tube rolling around inside in a reassuring manner. Yet something didn't feel right. Prying off the lid, he found the cheetah skin tightly rolled up and stuffed to one side as it had been before. The bronze tube sat next to it, appearing secure. But picking the tube up, he noticed it felt heavier than he remembered. With a shaking hand, he quickly pulled off the cap, releasing an outpouring of sand that dribbled onto his lap. As the last grain tumbled out, he peered in and saw that the silk scroll had vanished. His eyes bulged at the sudden realization that he'd been duped, and he struggled to catch his breath. The shock quickly turned to anger, and regaining his voice, he began screaming at the pilots.
"Turn back! Turn the airplane around! We must return at once!" he cried.
But his plea fell on deaf ears. In the cockpit, the two pilots suddenly had something more troubling of their own to contend with. The Mitsubishi G3M bomber, known in the West as a Nell, was not on a bombing mission at all. Flying casually alone at an altitude of 9,000 feet, the twin-engine aircraft was flying reconnaissance, probing the aerial resources of Russia that were rumored to have surfaced in Mongolia. With its easy conquest of Manchuria and successful advance into northern China, the Japanese had sharpened their sights on the important seaports and coal mines of Siberia to the north. Leery of the Japanese intent, the Russians had already bolstered their defensive forces in Siberia and recently signed a defense pact with Mongolia that allowed for the deployment of troops and aircraft in that mostly barren country. Already, the Japanese were busy gathering intelligence, testing and probing the defensive lines in preparation for an outright northern offensive that would be launched from Manchuria in mid-1939. The Nell had come up empty on its foray into eastern Mongolia, finding no sign of troop deployments or runway construction on behalf of Russian aircraft. If there was any Russian military activity in Mongolia, it would be much farther north, the Japanese pilot concluded. Below him was nothing but the occasional nomadic tribe, wandering the empty expanse of the Gobi Desert with their herd of camels.
"Nothing but sand out here," the Nell's co-pilot, a youthful lieutenant named Miyabe, said with a yawn. "I don't know why the wing commander is excited over this real estate."
"As a buffer to the more valuable territory to the north, I suspect," Captain Nobuji Nagishi replied. "I just hope we get repositioned to the front when the northern invasion occurs. We're missing all the fun in Shanghai and Peking."
As Miyabe stared at the flat ground beneath the plane, a bright glint of sunlight briefly flashed out of the corner of his eye. Scanning across the horizon, he tracked the source of the light, squinting at what he saw.
"Sir, an aircraft ahead and slightly below us," he said, pointing a gloved hand toward the object.
Nagishi peered ahead and quickly spotted the plane. It was the silver Fokker trimotor flying northwest toward Ulaanbaatar.
"She's crossing our path," the Japanese pilot noted with a rise in his voice. "At last, a chance for battle."
"But, sir, that's not a combat plane."
"I don't think it is even a Chinese airplane," Miyabi said, observing the markings on the Fokker.
"Our orders are to engage only Chinese military aircraft."
"The flight poses a risk," Nagishi explained away. "Besides, it will be good target practice, Lieutenant."
No one in the Japanese military was getting reprimanded for aggressive behavior in the Chinese theater, he well knew.
As a bomber pilot, he would be afforded few opportunities to engage and destroy other aircraft in the skies. It was a rare chance for an easy kill, and he wasn't about to pass it by. "Gunners, at your stations," he barked over the intercom. "Prepare for air-to-air action." The five-man crew of the attack bomber were immediately energized as they manned their battle positions. Rather than play the quarry of smaller and quicker fighter aircraft, as was their lot in life, the bomber crew suddenly became the hunter. Captain Negishi mentally computed a dead reckoning line of the trimotor's path, then eased back on the throttles and banked the bomber in a wide, slow turn to the right. The Fokker slipped by beneath them until Negishi eased out of the turn, which brought the bomber around and behind the silver trimotor. Negishi eased the throttles forward again as the Fokker loomed ahead. With a top speed of 216 miles per hour, the Mitsubishi was nearly twice as fast as the Fokker and easily closed the gap. "Ready with the forward guns," Negishi ordered as the unarmed plane grew larger in the gun sights. But the trimotor was not going to pose like a sitting duck. Randy Schott had seen the bomber first and tracked it as it curled around onto his tail. His hopes that the Japanese plane was just making a harmless flyby vanished when the Mitsubishi took up position squarely behind him and hung on his tail rather than fly alongside. Unable to outrun the faster military aircraft, he did the next best thing. The Japanese plane's turret gunner just squeezed the first round from his 7.7mm machine gun when the trimotor banked sharply left and seemed to stall in the air. The gunner's bullets sprayed harmlessly into the sky as the bomber quickly overshot the Fokker. Negishi was caught completely off guard by the sudden maneuver and cursed as he tried to muscle the bomber back toward the smaller plane. The rattle of machine gun fire echoed through the fuselage as a side gunner tracked the sudden juke by the Fokker and sprayed a long burst in its direction. Inside the Fokker, Hunt swore louder at the pilots as crates of artifacts began tumbling around the interior of the plane. A loud crash told him that a crate of porcelain bowls was suddenly smashed by the plane's violent turns. It wasn't until the Fokker banked sharply right and Hunt caught a glimpse out the side window at the Japanese bomber that he realized what was happening. In the cockpit, Schott tried every trick in the book to shake the Mitsubishi, hoping that the bomber would abandon the pursuit. But the Japanese pilot was angered by the earlier rebuff and pursued the Fokker relentlessly. Time and again, Schott would stunt and stall his aircraft to throw the bomber off its tail, causing the Japanese plane to circle around and reacquire the trimotor in its gun sights. The hunter would not give up the chase, and Schott would soon find the Mitsubishi back on his tail again until finally one of the gunners found his mark. The Fokker's rear stabilizer was the first to go, shredded in a hail of lead. Negishi licked his chops, knowing the plane could no longer turn left or right without the control of the stabilizer. Grinning like a wolf, he brought the bomber in close for the kill. As the gunner fired again, he was shocked to see the Fokker once again juke to the right, then pull up in a stall. Schott wasn't through yet. With Dave jockeying the throttles on the two wing-mounted engines, Randy was still able to duck and weave away from the Mitsubishi. Once again, the gunfire burst harmlessly into the fuselage, Hunt grimacing as another crate of artifacts was decimated. Wise to his opponent's tactics, Negishi finally swung the bomber around in a wide arc and approached the Fokker from the side. This time, there was no escaping the gunfire, and the Fokker's right-wing engine disintegrated under a fury of bullets. A plume of smoke burst from the engine as Schott shut down the fuel line before the motor caught fire. Jockeying the remaining two engines, he continued to fight with all his skills to keep the Fokker airborne and out of harm's way, but his hourglass finally ran out. A well-placed shot by the Mitsubishi's topside gunner severed the Fokker's elevator controls and effectively ended the flight of the Blessed Betty. Without the ability to control altitude, the wounded trimotor began a flat descent toward the ground. Choate watched helplessly as the Fokker plunged toward the dusty ground with its wings ajar. Amazingly, the airplane held its balance, gliding downward with its nose bent just a fraction forward. Shutting down the remaining engines just before impact, he felt the left wingtip clip the ground first, throwing the plane into a clumsy cartwheel. The crew of the Japanese plane watched with minor disappointment as the Fokker rolled across the ground, failing to explode or burst into flames. Instead, the silver trimotor simply flipped twice, then slid inverted into a sandy ravine. Despite the difficulty in downing the civilian plane, a cheer rang out aboard the Mitsubishi. "Well done, men. But next time we must do better," Negishi lauded, then banked the bomber back toward its base in Manchuria. On board the Fokker, Choate and his brother were killed instantly when the cockpit was crushed on the first roll of the aircraft. Hunt survived the crash, but his back was broken and his left leg nearly severed. He painfully clung to life for nearly 2 days before perishing in the jumbled wreckage of the fuselage. With his last gasp of energy, he pulled the lacquered box close to his chest and cursed his sudden turn of luck. As his last breath left him, he had no idea that still clutched within his arms, he held the clue to the most magnificent treasure the world would ever see.